A look at blood cancers, transitioning pediatric special needs patients to adult care, and a look at how night shift work can affect your health with fellow podcasters Dustin and Angela Ballard. If that's what you're looking for, you found it. It's The Nursing Show. Well, good day and welcome to this week's episode of The Nursing Show, our podcast for nurses by nurses. I'm your host, Jamie Davis, and I'd like to take this opportunity to thank all of you for checking out the program this week. We've got a great show for you. First up in this week's episode, we have a special interview on helping patients with suspected blood cancer. Then we chat with a mother and her child's doctor on how to transition special needs pediatric patients to adult specialists. Finally, we'll wrap up the show with a look at how we can help our bodies adjust to night shift work safely. We'll have that and more later on in this episode, coming up in just a bit. Before we get to all of that, though, I do want to make sure you follow up on the information that I talk about here with my guests on the show every week. And you can do that by heading over to nursingshow.com and check out the links there in each episode's show notes. There's also other articles there, so you can check out things like our free Nursing Show mobile app, student nurse tips, and a lot of other stuff. But make sure you're following up on what I talk about so that you understand how it applies to your own nursing scope of practice. If you do want to get back in touch with me, I always love to hear from you, so please drop me an email. You can send those emails in to me here at nursingshow@gmail.com. I love to hear from you, and I make sure I respond back to all the emails that come in, so send me things. You can send me links to news items or interview ideas or topic suggestions for future episodes. Whatever the case may be, keep those emails coming in. Also, a very special thank you to Physiocontrol for being my overall sponsor in this episode, as well as the American Heart Association for their partnership this month. Find out more about their links and everything else supporting The Nursing Show over in the show notes for this episode. That's it. I'll have some more contact information coming up later on, but let's go ahead and get on into this week's special news items coming right up. Leukemia and Lymphoma Society President Dr. Louis DeGennaro and patient Aaron Ruddy show firsthand how overwhelming and terrifying a blood cancer diagnosis can be. At 23, Aaron was told she had chronic myelogenous leukemia, CML, a rare blood cancer that up until that point had been ultimately fatal in the majority of its cases. Check out the upcoming segment where I talk with her and Dr. DeGennaro about how we as nurses can help recognize and help manage our blood cancer patients.
Hello, Jamie.
Hi, Dr. DeGennaro and Aaron. It's great to have you here. This is The Nursing Show. It's a program for nurses by nurses, and I'm always very interested in talking about, especially with patients themselves, about their experiences with different diseases. And, of course, cancer is so prevalent in so many different ways. Dr. DeGennaro, it's Blood Cancer Awareness Month, and there are lots of different blood cancers that nurses may or may not be aware of. Can you kind of talk to us about how they're different from other types of cancer?
Yeah, happy to, Jamie. You know, the World Health Organization just reclassified the blood cancers. When they bring in the genetic classifications, there are 140 different blood cancers. You know, the ones that we typically think about, leukemia, lymphoma, Hodgkin's disease, multiple myeloma, even those are buckets of diseases. Non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, when you break it down genetically, is a cluster of over 60 different diseases. But you and the nurses know what make these diseases different. They're cancers of the blood. They affect the blood cells. They affect the bone marrow. They affect the lymph nodes. And you also know that one of the things that makes them different is that there's no early detection for the blood cancers. There isn't a mammogram for leukemia or a PSA test for multiple myeloma. Patients present with a frank and full-blown disease. It's why the Leukemia and Lymphoma Society exists. We exist to find cures and therapies for the blood cancer so that when a patient does present to their physician, the physician can turn back and say, I have an effective therapy for you.
Aaron, I really appreciate you taking some time to share with us, because I think it's important for nurses to help understand what other people have done when navigating through a disease process. Can you share with us a little bit about your battle with cancer in this situation?
Sure. I was diagnosed about 15 years ago when I was just 23 with chronic myelogenous leukemia. And I found out through a routine blood test at my doctor's office. It was pretty shocking and devastating. But what was so crazy is within days of hearing those devastating words, "you have cancer," I found out that I was going to be okay, that I could maintain a normal life. There was a new drug that had just been approved by the FDA, a targeted therapy, a little pill that I could take, and it would kill the cancer cells without harming the healthy cells. So here I was, a new cancer patient, but I didn't have to lose my hair. I didn't have to spend time in the hospital. I didn't have to get sick just to get well, which, as you know, was a revolutionary idea in cancer treatment. And it worked. I went into remission quickly. I've remained in remission all these years. And I was even able to go off treatment three different times to have three children. So my journey has been a really incredible one. I've been lucky since day one, and I owe that to the Leukemia and Lymphoma Society, because they funded the drug that I was able to take. And so, as I'm sure you know, a lot of when you're going through these diagnoses and these diseases and the treatment, it's good to take your mind off of things. And for my family and I, it was getting involved with the Leukemia and Lymphoma Society and giving us a purpose outside of the treatment. To give back and to hopefully find some more of these miracle drugs for other patients, because not everyone has a story like mine, unfortunately. But I do feel, you know, incredibly lucky, and at 38, healthier, stronger than ever. So I personally don't plan on stopping my involvement with LLS and hoping to give other people this opportunity that I've had, and I feel so grateful for.
Well, thank you for sharing your story with us, and it's inspiring to hear that you were able to find a way to get involved and give back to others. Dr. DeGennaro, what is the prognosis out there for other targeted therapies like this and even cures for blood disorders like this?
The pipeline is incredibly full. And actually, before we talk about this, let me pause for just a minute, Jamie, and thank you and the other nurses for the care that they give our patients. We know that the nurses make that journey that these patients have with cancer much more tolerable than it would be without them, and I just want to say thank you. I can tell you the pipeline is chock full of new therapies, new targeted therapies, new immunotherapies. You know, you can't pick up a journal today without seeing something about an advance in immunotherapy. What excites me about this is that we're developing these in the blood cancers, but they're now paying benefit for patients with other forms of cancer, breast cancer, colon cancer, prostate cancer, places where we really haven't made significant advances. We're committed, the Leukemia and Lymphoma Society, we're committed to advancing new therapies. We're committed to educational programs for nurses, so you should know about listeners and viewers should know about this. Your listeners and viewers should also know about our copay assistance program. We have financial assistance for patients as well. You can find out about all of those things at our website, lls.org.
Excellent. Well, thank you both for sharing a short bit of time. I know we're kind of pressed for time this morning, but thank you for taking some time out of your day to talk with my audience and appreciate your kind words for nurses as well, Doctor.
Oh, you're very welcome.
Thank you.
Next, many children with neurological conditions such as epilepsy, cerebral palsy, metabolic disorders, and others have special physical or emotional needs. And as they get older, it becomes necessary to transition from a pediatric care team to an adult health care team. But for 1 in 6 children in the U.S. living with such disorders, resources to help this process have been historically limited, and many families need a lot of additional direction. Here to offer some guidelines on this topic are Dr. Lawrence Brown, the chair of the Child Neurology Foundation Transition Project Committee and authoring panel, and Loretta Boileau, whose child has a severe form of epilepsy. Check it out.
Hello, Jamie.
Good morning, Jamie.
Good morning, Dr. Brown and Loretta. It's great to have you both here on the show. This is the Nursing Show. It's a program for nurses and nursing students to talk about all kinds of different healthcare issues. And I'm particularly interested in this program. I actually transitioned my oldest daughter from her pediatric rheumatologist to her adult rheumatologist for her arthritis this year. So, this is a topic that's near and dear to my heart.
Great.
So, Dr. Brown, why don't we talk a little bit about this? Because this transitioning period, we all know in healthcare that anytime we transfer patient information from one healthcare professional to another, there can be a chance for information to be lost and kind of the ball to get dropped in some ways. So tell us a little bit about what you see as some of the key issues with this transition process.
Well, just to put it into perspective, since one out of every six children has a neurologic disorder, that's what we were focused on. But the principles that we developed are very easily transferable to other pediatric specialties. So we put together a team that was international experts that represented all the different important caregivers, nurses, child neurologists, adult neurologists, and others. And with the support of Eisai Pharmaceuticals, we came up with these principles in specific to the point you raised about the loss of information. First of all, we strongly suggested the development of a transition packet, one that could be given to the youths and their families early before they ever move on to adult care. And the second point that we implied and referred to is the next phase, which is the development of the electronic medical record as the repository for this information and hopefully to be easily transmitted from one institution to another.
Are there any particular issues that you think are unique to managing patients with neurological disorders that were unique to the transitioning process?
The only thing that is potentially unique, besides the specific of the disorders, is the remarkable percentage of kids that we have who unfortunately include intellectual or physical disabilities that are not as common among other specialties. And therefore, we had to consider what would happen if they were not capable of full independence and how important developing the legal implications so that they are fully protected and able to continue to have the services through their health care, their life situation, and their social aspects. So that's the only difference between the neurologic cases and the cases of somebody like your daughter with rheumatologic disorder.
Loretta, can you share with us a little bit about your experience, both as a parent and what you perceived for your child?
Sure. My son Daniel was diagnosed with Lennox-Gastaut syndrome, LGS, when he was quite young. So Dan, from this perspective, I thought of him as chronically ill. He had a lot of life-threatening situations growing up. He had a lot of different treatments to try and control his epilepsy, a lot of different experimental medications. So we developed a very close and trusting relationship with his pediatric neurologist. And as he got to be a little bit older and going through his teen years, we knew we were going to have to transition into an adult provider. At the same time, he was developmentally disabled, so we had to face the issue of guardianship, what his living situation would be as an adult. So there were a lot of different issues coming up at the same time. There wasn't a roadmap. There wasn't, the transition points that are brought out in Dr. Brown's and his colleagues' paper. So at one point, I just felt like I had all this information that needed to be collated and put together. What if I forgot things? What if some of the things that have been tried on him as a child were forgotten and an adult provider wanted to try them again, things that have failed? So there was a lot of anxiety there, a lot of worry that information would be lost and, you know, Dan would suffer or that his quality of life would suffer for those reasons. So the transition paper and the 8 core points that they bring out that can act as a bridge of communication or a roadmap for people, I think, is very, very important.
Doctor, what are some of the things that parents, from your perspective, that parents can do to better prepare themselves and their children for this transition? I mean, pediatric physicians in specialties, they almost become special friends of the children they treat. I mean, the relationship is very different from that of an adult provider.
I agree with you entirely. And I would just point out that it's not just the responsibility of the parents, but it's also the responsibility of all of us in the caring professions. And more so, the nurses have taken the lead along with social workers and others that are in partnership with the child neurologist. But some of the things that we can all do is begin the conversation early as 12 or 13 years of age. Not that we're ready to move on at that point, but transition is a process. It's not a moment in time. It's not that one and done. Transfer of care to another provider. It's getting ready to take on the mantle of adulthood. It's learning about the disease. It's learning about the medications. It's learning about the medication interactions and the effect of sleep and the effect of taking other drugs and alcohol and how we can best achieve the full independence. It needs to be done on a yearly basis because things change over time and we expect more and more. Too many kids that we see who are in college still don't know their diagnosis or still don't know how to reorder their medication if they run out or why they're taking it on a daily basis. Lastly, I would point out that in the unfortunate case like Loretta described, where either for physical or intellectual disabilities, they may not be fully independent. We want them to do as much as they can. And we also want to protect them legally with guardianship so that you can make those medical decisions for them if they can't do it themselves. And it doesn't come naturally and it has to be done before the age of maturity. Or else we just push them off a cliff when they turn 21 and they lose all the rights to early education through the special ed system.
Well, are there any tips that you'd like to share that you found helped you along the path?
Yes, I'd like to reiterate what Dr. Brown has said, that we need to start early. The more time you have, the better it is for both your child and yourself to go through that process. Finding the right team, the right doctor is critical. And lastly, I'd like to say that for more information on this process, you can go to two websites, advancingepilepsycare.com and childneurologyfoundation.org, two good sites.
Excellent. Well, I'll make sure we include those links in the notes for this episode and make sure our nursing audience files that information away because I think it's important, especially for those nurses in the pediatric end of things, but nurses on the other side that are going to be receiving these new patients in the practices where they work. So thank you very much, both of you, for participating and helping us learn a little bit about this process.
Thank you, Jamie.
Thank you, yeah.
Finally in this week's show is a chat with podcasters and healthcare professionals, Dr. Dustin Ballard and his wife and nurse, Angela Ballard. They are the hosts of the Medically Clear podcast, and they're here with us again to chat with us about some new research about managing shift work and the body's need to adjust to a lack of a regular sleep schedule.
Well, hello, Dustin and Angela. It's great to have you both here on the show again with Medically Clear podcast coming back on. And we've got some new research or at least some looking at existing research on shift work, which is exciting.
Yeah, we got interested in this, obviously, because both physicians and nurses do a lot of shift work. And so we found a study coming out of Iran in the journal Work, looking at oil refinery shift workers who had to shift from days to nights without really much chance to adjust in between, and whether melatonin helped them or not.
Yeah, thank you, Jamie, for having us back on. We really enjoy your show, and we enjoy the opportunity to talk a little bit about some of the research that we're diving into. And as Angela says, we are both in the medical field, and we both had to deal with shift work, sleep disorder on some level or the other. As an ER physician, especially in my residency training, we did these brutal 12-hour night shifts. And in retrospect, looking back, I did not handle my sleep pattern very well at all. And I'm sure a lot of night workers out there that have been doing it for a while have a pattern down. But for those who maybe are just starting out in the field, perhaps they haven't figured out the best way to manage their sleep during shift work switches or primarily night shift burden.
And I've seen some research over the past couple of years that I've covered on the show numerous times that looks at some of the negative health effects. It has some cardiovascular negative side effects of working night shifts over a period of time. What causes that? I mean, is it just the response of the body to being out of rhythm with the day-night cycle?
Well, yeah, I think that's a great question, Jamie. I think we don't really know for sure, at least the evidence we've reviewed on this. There are some theories out there from animal models. There's a great study from, or very interesting study from Science in 2013 from University of Rochester. And they looked at mice, and they looked at mice when they were either asleep or when they were under anesthesia. And they looked to see what happened in terms of the mingling of the cerebral spinal fluid, that is the fluid around the brain and spinal cord, and the interstitial fluid, which is the fluid around cells. And in the brain, they don't have a lymphatic drainage system like we do in the rest of the body. So the way that toxins get cleared, they think, at least from the mice model, is a mixing of those two fluids, which is much more dramatic, up to 60% more during sleep. And that clears away the beta amyloid toxins and the tau toxins that will lead to all the effects we see from sleep deprivation, such as excessive sleepiness, behavioral changes, slurring of the words because the temporal lobe gets affected, all these things that you'll notice if you only get a few hours of sleep, kind of feel like you're drunk.
Wow. So, you know, we've got these effects, and you said maybe there's a fix for this. Maybe there's a way to get our rhythms back on track.
Yeah, I mean, some good sleep hygiene. And one of the things we can talk about is the use of melatonin, and are we using it correctly? And some of the studies that we looked at showed that actually the doses of melatonin that you can buy over the counter are very high, and you actually don't need that much. You only need about 0.3 milligrams or less. We know that the melatonin we have here in our house is 5 milligrams. So even if we cut that pill in half, it's a lot more than you actually need. And if you take 10 milligrams, for instance, it actually becomes less effective. So starting with a low dose of melatonin can really help. And then also the timing of when you might take melatonin is important. About an hour before you want to fall asleep is a good recommendation, because melatonin tends to increase gradually, naturally in our bodies when the sun goes down. And if you think about it, you don't usually go to sleep immediately at sundown. You know, so our natural melatonin is gradually increasing as it gets darker in the evening and getting us ready to sleep. Sleep is becoming more inviting. So if you're going to take melatonin because you're a shift worker, for instance, and you want to take it in the morning, you want to be able to allow that gradual onset for yourself as well. So giving an hour of time is probably the best way to take it.
No, I think that's good to know. I mean, it's important for us to be aware of this, whether you're a nurse, a doctor, a paramedic, anybody that works any kind of shift work, even, you know, like the study did with oil workers, you need a way to reset your clock and help your body get back onto some sort of schedule. What about, has there been any research into best practices for let's say, employers to help people move from one shift to another. Was there anything about that?
You know, we didn't really dive into that particular topic too deeply, Jamie, but I do know from working in the emergency room that there is a movement in shift work scheduling for emergency departments where you have people cycle on to later shifts gradually, so over the course of a few days or even a week or so. So they might start with an early morning shift for a couple days and then move to mid-morning shift start time and then onwards and finally end with a night shift. And that does go along with sort of the gradual changes in circadian rhythm that are the best way to manage the shift work disorder. The other thing that many emergency departments are starting to do is end a night shift early before the sun comes up, because we're talking about melatonin. Melatonin and natural light are very linked in terms of the effects on the human body. In fact, depending on the type of light, either dim evening light or bright early morning light, there are opposite effects on the pineal gland in terms of melatonin release or suppression. And then this has an effect on the hypothalamus. So if you get off work at 7 in the morning, and this is what I used to do in residency, I would come home and I would, you know, I would get in the hot tub. We had a small little hot tub. I would crack out one beer and get the newspaper out. And I would think I was getting myself relaxed to sleep. But I was outside in bright natural light. And that light was suppressing melatonin from my pineal gland. And that was causing me to shift my circadian clock so that it was going to be harder for me to fall to sleep quickly. And I would wake up sooner during the day. So the big recommendation in terms of what shift work employers can do is try and look at scheduling shifts, in particular night shifts that end in such a way that you have some time to get home and go to sleep before natural light starts to mess up the whole circadian rhythm.
What's the difference between the melatonin that you're releasing when natural light hits your eyes and causes that release that wakes you up versus taking melatonin to help you sleep?
Well, melatonin is actually the only hormone you can buy over the counter in the United States, and 2% of Americans are already taking it. What the exact difference between what you buy and what your body makes is, I'm not sure. Do you know, Dustin?
Really no difference, Jamie, other than the fact that some of the preparations have other ingredients in them to extend the sort of lifespan of the melatonin. So that is something you do have to pay attention to if you are looking at melatonin over the counter, because there are a number of different formulations. There are also prescription formulations as well. But the actual active ingredient, the melatonin itself, is no different than what is produced in the body. However, it may
but
be
both,
much higher.
But one, it can either wake you up or help you sleep. It can do both?
Exactly. It depends on when you take it. So if you take melatonin early on in your sleep cycle, it may actually cause you to go to sleep later than you normally would. But if you take it late in your sleep cycle, like you would perhaps an hour before bedtime, then it can help you fall asleep. One thing you don't want to do is wake up in the middle of the night and then take melatonin because you can't sleep. That will not work very well, because melatonin is really all about helping to regulate your circadian clock, and your clock is already off kilter if you wake up in the middle of the night and try and adjust it.
Sounds good. So anything else out there? I mean, you guys are my watchers of the research. I know we've been talking about shift work, but I'm sure there's some other interesting research that's kind of been on your radar. What kind of things have you been covering on your podcast recently?
So we're preparing to put together a podcast on a topic a little far afield of this, but it is very important, and that is end-of-life care in this country versus in other countries. And there's an interesting article that came out in JAMA last year that looked at what happened to cancer patients at the end of life and where did they die. And despite what we might hear about the United States had a relatively low percentage of patients that died in the hospital compared to other countries. The United States and Netherlands were at the low end of that. Now, there are some difficulties with this research because it came from large national databases. So we're going to kind of get into the nuts and bolts of that, as we like to do, Jamie. But it does bring up the interesting question. And of course, Atul Gawande has written about this extensively, about, you know, how do we approach end of life and our, you know, so-called golden years in this country? And is there a major change in approach that is underway right now. We think there probably is. So we thought it was an interesting topic to dive into. So that's coming up soon on Medically Clear.
Excellent. And let folks know where they can find that, because I think it's a podcast that all healthcare professionals should be checking out, as well as people in the lay public that are interested in medical research. Where can they find you guys?
Well, you can find us on iTunes with Medically Clear. You can also look us up on Medium as Medically Clear Podcast. And we have a Podbean too, so Medically Clear on Podbean. And you can email us at medicallyclear@gmail.com. If there's a study that you want us to cover or a topic you want us to look into, we're always interested in hearing from our listeners.
Awesome. Well, both of you, thanks so much for reaching out to me, and a very interesting topic. I'll make sure we, of course, include links to your podcast in the show notes for this episode. But also, if you would, send me any links to this particular study we talked about in this episode, and I'll make sure we have links to that in the show notes as well.
Yeah, we'll definitely do that.
We'll do that. One last thing on sleep that is perhaps worth looking into if you do have shift work disorder is natural light. And you can buy these light boxes or even light visors, and they may be a substitute for taking melatonin or anything else. So we talk a little bit about that on our podcast, and it's actually something that you can dive into on your own, a nice and very natural way to regulate your sleep just based on when you're exposed to light, Jamie. So maybe that's something we can talk about on a brighter, lighter day.
Sounds great. All right. Awesome. Well, you guys take care, and we'll have you back soon.
Okay. Thanks, Jamie.
Thank you. Appreciate it, Jamie.
That's going to close out this week's episode of The Nursing Show. I want to thank all of you for checking out the program this week. Make sure you follow up, though, on all of the information you picked up in this episode. Head over to nursingshow.com and check out the episode show notes. There's a link right there at the top of the page. In there are listings for all of the episodes of The Nursing Show. From the most recent one at the top, you can scroll down and go all the way back to the very first episode. But I want you to get the full information there with links to other resources so that you understand how to apply what you hear on the show to your own nursing practice or studies. If you want to get back in touch with me, shoot me an email. You can send that in to nursingshow@gmail.com. I respond back to every email that comes in, and I want to hear from you. So send me your comments, your questions, suggestions, news links. Help support the Nursing Show community with your input. You can also get the Nursing Show email newsletter. There's a link and form right on the right-hand side of the Nursing Show site, so fill out that short form, and we'll send you the links to each episode's show notes directly to your email inbox each week. You can also connect with me on social media sites. I'm available there under the handle PodMedic, so you can find me there under twitter.com/PodMedic and facebook.com/PodMedic, so friend or follow me. You can also become a member of the community over on Facebook by liking the Nursing Show Facebook page at facebook.com/nursingshow. Click the like button there and join the conversation on that page. I post other nursing and healthcare articles and pictures on the Nursing Show site throughout the course of each week and over at the Nursing Show page, so check it all out. That's it for me. I'm your host, Jamie Davis. I'll be back with more episodes here of The Nursing Show. Remember, it comes out every Friday for you, so you can wrap up your nursing week. In the meantime, please remember to stay safe and stay tuned here to The Nursing Show.